Good evening from Washington. My name is Truman Taylor. The name of our program is The Senators Respond, with Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island. And as we're prone to do every 3 weeks when this program does appear, we're again going to tell you how it works. The senators are answering your questions. These are questions which have been sent in over the past 3 weeks since we were last on the air by viewers. And if you have a question which you would like to put to either Senator Kennedy or Senator Chafee or both, send them in to the Senators Respond, WTEV, Channel 6, either New Bedford, Massachusetts, or Providence, Rhode Island. Either address will do. And having said that, let's get to the first question, which goes to you, Senator Kennedy. There are people who say that raising the minimum wage will mean that a lot of employers will cut down on the number of people they hire. And so consequently, won't this have an adverse effect overall? I suppose what they mean, the lower scale employees will be starting to get cut up. There won't be as many jobs for them going around.
Well, I think the most recent studies have shown a number of factors. First of all, the raising of the minimum wage has an important impact on the number of women that have joined the labor market. It is more appealing to women to join the labor market with a higher minimum wage. Secondly, that those youths who are receiving the minimum wage effectively, and the times where the Congress has raised the minimum wage in the past, have not lost their jobs. Those are youths that have had part-time jobs for a temporary period, have seen some reduction in employment. So where you have certain impact on the employment market, where some it has been expanded with youths that have had the permanent jobs, have been held. The people that have held, the young people who have the permanent jobs, basically are the sons and daughters of middle-income, low-income, and working poor people. The part-time jobs have been more of the affluent groups in our society. I think beyond this, which are, can lead you to about what conclusion that you're looking for, I, of course, feel very strongly that the minimum wage, what we're talking about, to permit the people of this country, particularly heads of households or otherwise, is absolutely essential if we're expecting people to be able to afford to live. I mean, the increase now over the four-year period going up to 342 will still be barely at the poverty level in 4 years from now, and with a natural assumption of the increase in the inflation rate. It's so interesting to me to hear those voices in the Congress that are opposed to the minimum wage also being opposed to unemployment insurance and opposed to welfare changes. I mean, here are people that want to work, that are attempting to work, and without getting that kind of minimum wage, I don't see how you can possibly keep a family of four together with less or approximately $100, $120 a week with less many of the deductions that they have. So I'm hopeful. I support the minimum wage, and I also support that we make it consistent across the board.
Let me just play devil's advocate. I know that you want to say something in regard to the subject to Senator Chafee, but if you don't think that raising the minimum wage to either 260 or 340, whatever it may be a year from now or 2 years from now, that the fellow who would hire a couple of maintenance men now for $2 an hour, $2.30 an hour, when it gets up to 340, you don't think he'll hire one man to sweep the floors instead of two? I think that's what this person is really asking.
Well, all we can really do is look at both the past, what the track record has been, and the most recent very extensive studies that have been done by Brookings on this particular issue, and they describe the situation I described previously. Beyond that, I think when you're talking about the youth kind of differential, what you have to be very careful about is that you're not going to, by having a lower differential in terms of a teenage youth, that you don't fire the head of the household in order to take either a part-time person or two very part-time people and fire maybe two permanent people to take two part-time people that are youths and therefore replace the head of the household with teenagers, because they're able to pay them a differential on it. And that obviously is a factor as well. You want to make sure that in terms of any kinds of incentives, that you're not going to try and see that particularly the heads of households are going to be effectively lose their jobs with some kind of incentive for paying less than the minimum wage to others.
Senator Chafee, would you like to express your
thoughts? Well, I think there is some statistical basis for that theory that if you increase the minimum wage, you lose some jobs or eliminated from the market. In your case, the person who was hiring two people to sweep the floors, what he might well do is hire one person, get a machine. So that, true, some people will be eliminated from the job market. However, the way I look at it, and I supported the increase in the minimum wage, is I personally would just hate to live on what the minimum wage is now. And so I like to see the people get a little more. Secondly, one of the proposals to take care of this problem of job eliminations is to have what they call a youth differential. In other words, you can pay young people under 20 a little bit less than the minimum wage, with the idea that thus they'll learn the skills to keep a job. There are a lot of youths are caught in a catch-22 situation now. Seek a job. Have you had experience? No. Well, then you can't have a job. So the theory is that if we can have this youth differential, employers will be encouraged to hire some young people. Now, I supported that. It doesn't seem to be going very far in Congress, though.
What about, this isn't part of the listener's question, but what about this indexing? Putting it up every year and tying it to the average manufacturing wage or some...
Well, that's been shot down because, for a variety of reasons, I think the principal reason that indexing was shot down was that it's a permanent thing, and I think Congress wants to keep control of the minimum wage, to take a look at it every 2-3 years. The Senate has passed a bill advancing the minimum wage for 4 more years in different steps. And at the end of 4 years, then they'll be compelled to take another look at it. So I was opposed to the indexing. I thought that it let it out of Congress's hands. It gets us stuck with an arbitrary figure that certain 52% of the average manufacturing wage. I just didn't like that.
But wouldn't it kind of tie it into the cost of living if we were to put the minimum wage on some sort of index for one of the major manufacturing industries that is controlled or supported by a union?
Well, I'd agree with Senator Chafee. I think it's a responsibility that for the Congress to review this. There may be other kinds of ways, as we see now with the announcement on Friday of the employment situations. We're seeing a change in the profile of the unemployment, and it's considerably different than what it was 10 years ago, even with the types of people that are unemployed. And I think it's imperative for the Congress to review these factors, to try and find ways, even including the questions of the minimum wage, to target governmental leadership to the extent that it can be, and working with the private sector in areas to help relieve. And I think there's just the continuation of indexing is, I would have share the same reservations as the Senator Chafee has about it.
Senator Chafee, this viewer sends this question to you. I think probably was prompted by a recent demonstration in Providence by the Department of Transportation of air safety bags. And he says, the government seems to be ready to order car manufacturers to put air safety bags in all new cars. This is going to really hike the price of these cars. Why do those of us who don't want airbags have to buy them just because the government tells us to?
Well, the price they estimate for the increased cost for the airbags is about $112. Now, the person logically says, if I don't want to have an airbag, why should I have to have one? I think the answer really is this, that when people are injured or killed or maimed on our highways, it just doesn't end up their responsibility, their injury. It ends up an injury to the entire society. They're hospitalized, they're out of work, their families are often thrown onto welfare or put into very reduced circumstances. And so I think it's the responsibility of us all to reduce the injuries and killings in the highway to the greatest possible extent. And I must say, these airbags, I've seen some films, and the films are obviously pretty dramatic, but were very, very convincing on the safety effects of airbags. And it's estimated that it will very substantially reduce the number of deaths and, of course, injuries in the highways. Now, people say, oh, well, what's the matter with seat belts? Unquestionably, seat belts will do everything an airbag will do. But the trouble is only 20% of the people put on their seat belts. And so I am supporting the airbags. I know that everybody in Rhode Island is not going to be for that, but I just think if they could see these films and demonstrations, they'd be convinced.
Senator Kennedy, would you care to say anything on that?
No, I support the devices as well. I think the additional factor has been estimated that it will be implemented by 1982. Well, best estimate is it'll save 10,000 lives a year, over 100,000 serious injuries, and that actually, in terms of the consumer, that in the period of anywhere from 4 to 5 years, it will actually mean a reduction in terms of the insurance rates.
That's a very good point. And, the person will save.
In terms of the dollars and cents, it will mean savings. And I think that those are not inconsequential factors. You know, the Congress establishes 55 miles an hour. You could say, well, why? I think I can drive safely at 60 or 65. But they find that you can correlate the relationship of speed, obviously, to the savings of lives. This is obviously a balance. I don't think anyone would question that a state has a right to require, like motorcyclists, to wear a helmet. And so that they're to protect their lives. People say, well, I ought to be able to drive my motorcycle without a helmet. I mean, what business is it of the state or local community, local ordinances? Mm. So it is obviously the balance in terms of it, and it's important one to consider. I don't think any of us want to see unnecessary and infringement on individuals' rights on these factors, but there are, as Senator Chafin pointed out, very, very important consequences in terms of the safety factors.
There does seem to be a feeling in this country, though, that safety legislation shouldn't be mandated. The helmets, for instance, that Senator Kennedy just mentioned. Now they were outlawed in Rhode Island, and now that law has been taken off the books. Isn't that right? That you can now drive a motorcycle in Rhode Island.
That's right, and there
have
been a tremendous increase in motorcycle deaths. Now I'm not sure it's cause and effect, but. There was some counter-argument on the safety point on that, as you recall, people saying that with their helmets they couldn't
broke their necks
see,
if they hit their heads,
they couldn't see out of the corners of their eye and so forth. I'm not a motorcyclist, so I haven't got all the answers.
But they do demonstrate.
But let me, in this area about the appropriate role, we passed in another area, say in the medical device area or legislation, you know, people talking about should things be considered at the federal level. Up to a year and a half ago, there was no medical device legislation. There were thousands, tens of thousands of women that died from perforated uteruses from IUDs that were ineffective. Now, what's the family supposed to do? Go ahead and sue the manufacturing company? Or shouldn't people assume when there are important kinds of devices like a pacemaker or an IUD or something that's going to be implanted in the body that someone is going to have taken a look at it? Do people want to say, well, the federal government, I'm going to take pills or I'm going to eat certain kinds of foods, where the dangers in terms of insecticides or pesticides and herbicides and the impact that can have on your children? Do they want to say, well, we don't want anything. We want to be able to decide these factors for themselves on it. Now, these are obviously balances in terms of where an individual ought to be able to make judgments in terms of their own kind of well-being and also in terms of the common kind of community, and those are delicate balances between local ordinances and state and federal. And they're not always clear, and obviously people have a healthy, you know, difference in terms of where you ought to draw those lines. But, we shouldn't lose track about factors. You know, people don't complain so much when they are protected. Yeah. But when they're not, it's a sort of a different kind of a situation.
I think just judging by the tone of the question, that the viewer was saying that it might smack of big brotherism, which seems to be something that we're all looking out for these days. Senator Kennedy, here's another question. If in our effort to help black people and other minorities have a better life, we seem to have overcompensated in many areas. Now it's hard, in some cases, for white students to get into colleges and to get jobs in some industries which are forced to meet quotas for minorities. Is the Senate doing anything to guard against this reverse discrimination?
Well, of course, the fact of the matter is, in terms of employment situations, if you're looking at you know, the comparisons of where employment and where principal unemployment, it's clearly in terms of the inner cities, it's clearly in terms of the blacks, clearly related to those that haven't got skills. I mean, if you take half of the children that attend New York public schools drop out before. I mean, how do you, the half of the ones between 8 and 12 drop out, do not graduate. The problems in many of our major urban areas in terms of education are not training children to be able to be employable. Now that's contrasted, I think, to what's happening in the vocational schools. Very effective in our state in southeastern Massachusetts, where we have excellent ones, as well as in Rhode Island and the rest of the Commonwealth. So the question, I think, they might be talking. I don't know whether you want to get into the Bakke case or whatever, but. I think if we're able to develop the skills, the training, and create the climate and atmosphere in terms of the employment opportunities, then you don't have people really fighting for the same kind of job, whether it be black, brown, or yellow, but you open up the opportunities for employment. I mean, the key, the fact of the matter is, in terms of the economy, is having an expanded economy with price stability. We've been able to do that within the last 15 years with some degree of success. And then you didn't have the kind of conflict that you had between the races and seeking certain kinds of jobs. But you do when you have a continued kinds of unemployment figures that you've had over the period of the last 5 months. Now, you know, there are different... You know, there's different aspects of that question. We can get into any aspect that you want, but if it's just in the questions of employment, I think the key is to have expanded kinds of job opportunities for all, black and white alike. You balance the employment issue. I think the key, basically, to the problems that we're facing in this country are jobs. I think that's the number one issue. I think it is in Massachusetts. I think it is in the country, and the question is how you can have jobs and also have limit on the prices of inflation. But when you bring that hammer down in terms of jobs, then you're going to have the kind of strife that we have seen in the past in terms of black and white and others trying to claw and scratch and trying to get jobs. And that is going to continue no matter what kind of policy we have.
Do you think that in order to accomplish this the way you've outlined it, that a little bit of reverse discrimination is almost necessary?
Now, I'm opposed to quotas, but I do also feel that there has to be some kind of an affirmative effort and action to ensure that people are going to be included in our employment situations, in our universities, in our medical schools, among our doctors, in industry. And I think that's important, but I don't think that has to be able to do it. I mean, universities take sons and daughters of alumni. They take sons and daughters of people that make large kinds of contributions. I mean, they do in some of our best universities in Massachusetts take good athletes. And so do you say, well, you've taken a good athlete and because I can't run the 100, is that discrimination or whatever? I don't think the criteria ought to be as broadly based so that it reflects a value system to try and ensure that you're going to meet basic kinds of educational requirements, but then it ought to be broadly based to be available to the citizens and not to work to a narrow sector, which it does in many sense at the present time.
Senator Chafee?
I don't like specific quotas. Let's just stick to education for a minute. I don't like specific quotas. But at the same time, I think any university has a requirement to have as broad a diversity of undergraduates or graduates as possible. Now, I'm sure that if you live in Massachusetts, it's probably a lot harder to get into Harvard than if you live in Wyoming. Wyoming, the state of Wyoming, yeah. Because Harvard is seeking a balanced, diversified undergraduate class. And the same way, they want blacks in the class because blacks represent a certain part of our society. Furthermore, I think the thrust of the affirmative action programs is to bring the minorities, blacks, minorities, in so that they'll have a better chance in life. I think it was Lyndon Johnson said that it isn't enough to bring everybody equal to the starting line. You've got to make sure we're interested in not just equality of opportunity, we're interested in equality of results. And so I support the affirmative action program. I don't like a system whereby some medical school has 100 students and 19 places reserved for blacks. I think that's, it shouldn't be that type of quota, but it should be a goal to have a, to have all different parts of our society represented, and including the minorities.
If it's not a quota system, what else could it be? If as Senator Kennedy pointed out, that elementary school children, blacks and other minorities, are dropping out at 8 to 12 years old, how can you, if you need 100, if you have 100 openings in a medical school and there are 100 applicants, chances are most of those 100 applicants are going to be from affluent white middle-class families.
But that is, see, that's not, no university should have to take an unqualified student. I mean, that's a given factor. But as the question is when you have a range of qualified students, do you only go by the grades and only the results of the SAT tests? Or do you consider a broader kind of an experience? You can take in terms of the universities like at Harvard, and I'm sure at the others, they take a certain percentage of those students that score in the 750 to 800 percentile, a certain percent from the 650 to 750 percentile, and a certain one probably from about 6 to 750 percentile. But they don't just take every for their list everybody that has scored the closest to 800, so there are other factors which enter into this, and that's a recognition that there's a variety of qualities which we need in our society. We need lawyers, we need dentists, we need workers, we need industrial managers, and a university's role. You know, a university is a tax exempt organization, and that is because it serves a community. And in a community is made up and representative of a variety of different factors and forces and interests. And that's basically, if you go back to the oldest kind of colonial records, you'll see that it was supposed to be involved in the community and reflect a community. And I think what we're interested, obviously, is seeing that it reflects a community. But obviously, there must be the standard in terms of qualifications. I think that is given. I don't think there's any kind of question that you're going to take an unqualified student, or that there ought to be any kind of action, as certainly at the congressional or level, that requires that you do. I know of none, no suggestion of it, and I certainly wouldn't support it.
Shall we go on, or did you have
next
something
question?
To add to
that? Next question. You blinked when I talked about Wyoming. What I meant was Harvard is seeking a geographic broadness in their students.
I don't know, there's nobody from Wyoming at Harvard, is there?
Oh, they said. You know, the number of Massachusetts people that go to Wyoming, though, too. The university. I remember 5 or 6 years ago being out there, and I think half of their starting football team were from high schools in Massachusetts.
For goodness sakes. Here's one that kind of gets into the whole energy thing, but it's pegged on oil. And it was addressed to Senator Chafee because I think it was, although the letter didn't state it, I think it was Sandy Amato, who the fuel oil allocation director in the state of Rhode Island, I think is his title. The other day, a Rhode Island official said that by the end of the year, the fuel oil we heat our homes with will be up to 52 or 53 cents a gallon. What can be done about this? Pretty soon, a lot of people won't be able to heat their homes.
Well, I'm not necessarily sure that those facts were based on, what those facts were based on, the suggestion would be 52 cents. It might have been under the so-called wellhead tax, although I'm not sure that it would bring it up that much. The price of oil is going to go up, undoubtedly. Everything else seems to go up. And all we can do is make every effort in our personal lives to conserve, to insulate. As you know, the Senate and the Congress have passed legislation encouraging insulation, giving tax credits for people who do so. We've just individually got to make these efforts. And I feel very strongly that we've also got to make efforts to encourage the production of new oil, new gas, and bringing in new types of heating fuels, fuels. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what some of the legislation we've been working on here during Congress recently is intended to do. But I don't know where he gets the 52 cents from.
Could I add One more item which Senator Chafee and myself and others within the New England Senate delegation, at the consideration of the utility part of the President's program, we were able to gain from Mr. O'Leary, from the Energy Office, a assurance that the residual oil which comes to New England in terms of the entitlement program would be increased to 80% of entitlement. Now, what that means is that the residual oil which are used to heat our hospitals, our schools, many of our industries, and are used to provide 60% of the electricity will be reduced approximately 5% over last year. And so this is good news. It effectively will save New Englanders between $140 and $170 million of dollars this year. The price of oil for us has not varied. It's basically between $12.50 and $13.50 in terms of that which is imported. And obviously, we have depended upon the entitlement program, which means they can blend the more expensive oil with the older oil to get a more equitable price. And the more entitlement that we get means the more the lower price oil we get, and the less we have to spend on the newer for residual oil, the better it'll be in terms of the consumers. And this will mean in the area now of the residual oil and the electric utilities should mean about 5%, 3 to 5% reduction on utility bills for people in Rhode Island and in Massachusetts this year. Now, that's different from the specific question on the home heating oil aspect, but I think we have to continue to work on that. But that was a joint effort that was made with the New England delegation, and we got a strong assurance of the commitment of the administration. That can be primarily done by administrative and executive order, which Mr. O'Leary has given us assurance that he would do it. There's some aspects that are going to have to take in legislation, but we're working closely together on it.
So you see, what was the percentage again of a decrease in the
electric bill? Just the electric bill, electric utility, on the $100, it'll be 5%, $5 on that.
Although I think anybody would make a mistake to rush out and figure that next year their electric bill is going down 5%. This is the cost of fuel to the utilities, and utilities have got other expenses that are going up. So tell everybody
these
not
savings
to rush out
will be over what would otherwise have been an increase. And I think just on the fuel adjustment program, they ought to see it in Rhode Island and also see it in terms of Massachusetts this year on the fuel adjustment aspect of it.
That's a good point to cease our activities on this program, a kind of an upbeat thing. Prices are going down, hopefully.
Cautiously. I mean, these are little by little, but we're trying to restrain. But it was a good cooperative effort, I think, by the whole delegation. And I hope we can continue to work on it.
We'll be back in 3 weeks. Let me remind you once more very quickly, if you have a question for either Senator Kennedy or Senator Chafee, send it to WTV 6, New Bedford, Massachusetts, or Providence, Rhode Island. I'm Truman Taylor. Have a good night tonight and a better day tomorrow.